Second Vatican on baptism. I'll just put the words down and then I will comment on the words. So what time do I go? Where have I already gone? What time did we start?
Quarter to two.
Oh, I think we should pause, shouldn't we?
Yes.
And without comment, unless there are questions, okay? Otherwise, we'll spend so much time on the quizzes. I'll give the answer, and, well, maybe one or two words, but no commentary, really. Number one, there is a real falsification of the Catholic liturgy going on in many places today. Yes? That's what the Pope thinks. Second, the faithful have a right to a true liturgy, which means the liturgy desired and laid down by the Church. Nobody missed that. Viva! Number three, it is permitted in the liturgy to substitute other writings for the Scriptures. No, it's not. Number four, the Gospel must be read by a priest or deacon. One of you thought somebody else could read it. Well, it should be a priest or a deacon. Fifth, it is wrong to modify the Eucharistic prayers approved by the Church. Well, just the other day, the Missionaries of Charity, the Superior said, "Father, what do you think of this?" And she showed me a collection of Eucharistic prayers published by the Paulist Press, Bread That Is Blessed and Broken. Have you seen it? Well, looks very pious. All kinds of concocted Eucharistic prayers. And some, I am sure, are not valid. Number six. At concelebrated masses, all the priests must wear at least an alb and stole. Seven. In the Latin rite, the bread used for Mass must be unleavened. Eight. At communion, the faithful may themselves pick up the host and the chalice. No. Nine. The faithful may receive communion standing or kneeling. That's true. 10. The consecrated wine may be reserved after communion. No. Now the parallel columns. Some very interesting. I think what happened was, you know I made a mistake, don't you? See? Whatever happened, I put unleavened bread next, should have been matched with the Eastern liturgy. What should it be? Leavened bread. So, oh, this is delightful. 23 said, well, that 23, I see, so that it corresponds, is a 23 blank is?
Father, it means that 23 had something other than either a blank or Eastern.
I see, bread. Okay. Well, I don't blame you because you probably got yourselves mixed up because I made the mistake. So it should be leavened bread. Sacred vessels, of course, is number 18. That's noble and durable, should be. Women, 16. Not altar servers. I hope nobody put down 18 for women. I won't even dare ask if anybody did. Well, genuflection is 11 before the Blessed Sacrament. 12, tabernacle should be prominent, noble, and not transparent. Okay. 13, televised masses should be of exemplary quality. I just think to myself, what could 24 people, do you mind if I, if you're not embarrassed to give me the answers you gave, for example, for, well, only two missed that. Isn't that good? For women, only two missed it. For genuflection, five missed it. For tabernacle, 11. What did some of you say for the tabernacle that is not quite correct? Would you mind telling me, sister?
I put exemplary quality.
Exemplary quality. Well, you're right. But then what did you do with prominent, noble, and not transparent? Thanks for crediting me with an imagination. But 24 missed on televised masses. Will you mind tell me what some of the answers you gave for televised masses?
Not omitted.
Please?
Not omitted.
Not? Not omitted. Well, that's... I mean, you've got a point there. Oh, isn't that? You never know what to expect. I really ought to probably spend a little more time on this. Thanksgiving after communion, that's 14. That's not to be omitted. By the way, I think all communities, well, at least many that I know, should look to that. There are good communities that just rush out of Mass right after communion time. You know, they may finish, well, the few minutes that are left after communion time. Now, for example, here when you have communions to the sick, that takes up some time, but you know what I'm saying, though. I think a lot of people just don't put in at least 10 minutes after having received communion that you can be in prayerful adoration. St. Teresa of Avila says that's the principal source of grace. I think she's right. The Thanksgiving after communion. And the schedule, I think, should be so worked out that things are not rushed. Then, sign of reverence, that's before communion. Then, the unleavened bread we took care of. Homily is number 20, given by priest or deacon. That is very widely disobeyed. Would you agree? All kinds of people are giving homilies. Catholics, non-Catholics, Jewish people, Buddhists. This is in New York City.
You mean those people in the Catholic Church?
And the Eucharistic prayer is number 19. He is not set by the people.
I attend a church frequently where after, the bread is blessed and the chalice is blessed, the plate and the chalice are left together on the altar. And the people come up and they take it. But that is, you're saying, that's improper.
Sure it is. In fact, now the Missionaries of Charity, I can tell you this, coming Thursday, I teach both the active and the contemplative branch. I come for 7 o'clock Mass in the Bronx to say Mass and give a conference to the active group. And a superior asked me, would I please spend at least one conference, 40 minutes, about what may and what may not be done at the altar. They're getting so many opinions from priests. They read this, and the priests tell them that they've got permission. Well,
Father, our church, though, was not mentioned in the booklet whether or not dialogue homilies are permitted. Some of the college campuses and churches I've been to have what they call dialogue homilies. The priest will begin the homily and then ask for open discussion. What's the church's opinion on that?
Well, I don't think there's any strict prohibition of a dialogue homily. At least I know of none. However, some that I've attended and that I've heard about really cease to be homilies. In other words, it would be against number 20 on the right side if the homily is to be given by the priest or deacon. A dialogue can degenerate into what is no longer a homily. Now, I have asked, for example, some of you that member at Elverson with the children, the retarded children. I felt it was a good way of asking them for some feedback, a question here and a question there. So that kind of a dialogue, or to that extent, but where the contribution from the congregation really substitutes for the priests, well, then it's a cop-out. It's not a homily, except in name. And I think this is what, frankly, is happening. It's such a discussion, people can tee off, they talk, and the priest is more a kind of a master of ceremonies. That's not a dialogue homily, because it's not a homily. A homily is given by a person who may, of course, on occasion, ask a question or get some feedback. This was done, we know, even by Christ, right? Where he would ask them, or they would, Peter at least, would volunteer. Any further questions? Okay. You've taken your quiz, have you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Sister?
I have a question. When you have exposition right after celebration of Eucharist, put the host on a pattern or whatever and just leave it up like that, but could you do the same thing with the chalice, leave the chalice on the altar?
No.
No?
No, the... Okay. You mean for adoration?
Yes.
No, not for that specific purpose. In other words, it's there, and of course it's adorable while it's there, but it should be consumed. There's such risk of profanation for the consecrated chalice that it just has never been, even in the Eastern Church, which, as you know, has many things that we don't have, they do not have, they do not reserve the consecrated chalice. Okay. Let's pick up now, and I'd like to finish up the sacrament of baptism today. We go till 3:45, is it? Or rather,
3:45.
Is it 3:45?
Yes.
Let's see. Let's get this straight. What time is it now? 3:45. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong. Oh yes, 3:45. Now this is a takeoff on what we've already seen. In other words, there are certain things which the Second Vatican Council has added to what we've been talking about. Remember when we said that the baptismal character assimilates us to Christ's priesthood, makes us members of the church, and incorporates us into Christ. But there has been some remarkable development of doctrine by and since the Second Vatican Council on each of those three levels. There's a fourth coming down if we have time for it. First, it is the basis of the liturgical life. We can never stress too often or too strongly that the liturgy is the worship of the whole Christ, head and members. But the only ones who are members are those who were baptized. Liturgical life, therefore, begins with baptism, by which we are enabled to engage in the liturgy, because it's only through baptism that we are members of Christ's body. Secondly, through the sacrament of baptism we receive the grace of sacrifice. In other words, it is through baptism that we obtain the light and especially the strength to surrender what we like in acknowledgement of God's sovereignty and our dependence on Him. Which, by the way, when we come to the sacrament of matrimony, we shall learn, as we already know, that the only marriage which is absolutely indissolvable is one in which both parties have been baptized, mind you, before they marry. People who have not been baptized before they marry, their marriage is permanent, but not absolutely indissolvable. Right? There was such a thing as a Pauline privilege. There was such a thing as what they called the Petrine privilege. A baptized Christian marries a non-baptized person. That marriage can be dissolved. How? By entrance into a sacramental marriage if one of the two does not want to live peaceably with the baptized person. All right? So I think the most dramatic evidence of the grace of sacrifice that we receive in baptism is that that's the primary condition for an indissoluble marriage. And nobody, but nobody, who is married will deny that marriage is a life of sacrifice, in case nobody has told you. You either decide to sacrifice or you don't stay married. Yes?
Does that mean that someone who has married someone else who is not baptized and the marriage is dissolved, that that person can marry again?
Yes.
The baptized person?
Yes. Because unless both are baptized at the time of marriage, neither receives the sacrament. And only sacramental marriage is absolutely indissoluble. Yes?
Father, one isn't baptized when they're married and then she gets baptized later. Would that?
Well, if she got baptized or he got baptized after the marriage, well, then that's it. Then it becomes a sacrament when the non-baptized person is baptized.
Father, suppose they were married out of the church and not baptized, and then they got baptized later. Then it would still become the sacrament of marriage. Their marriage.
Well, are we talking about Catholics or non-Catholics?
Non-Catholics. They aren't Catholics. If they got baptized Catholic later, would they have to be remarried then?
No. Although it's a good idea to have them exchange their marriage consent. But by implication, if they continue cohabiting, that they do accept each other, you see.
Excuse Brother. Me, Father, you were saying last week that, or rather 2 weeks ago, you were saying that all non-Roman are in fact Roman because of their valid baptism.
Well,
perhaps you didn't use the word.
I didn't use those words. Yes, that's right. I didn't use those words. What if we save that for the ecumenical movement, if we get to that, all right? In other words, baptized, provided they're validly baptized, brother. I know we'd like to have a more close circle, but provided a person is validly baptized, that person becomes a member of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes. Now, although they are...
They don't think so. They would vehemently deny it.
Does diocese, then, recognize them as being validly baptized when, for instance, he is marrying a Catholic and a girl who is a Catholic and attending the, going to Mass and so forth, and a boy who is an Anglican but yet validly baptized, are they both receiving the sacrament?
Well, provided the marriage is valid. Are you assuming the marriage is valid?
It's being performed in the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes, they both receive the sacrament.
Yes, thank you.
In fact, now, look, we're not on the sacrament of matrimony yet. We've just finished the baptism. But lucky we have two semesters to the course. Two Presbyterians, both baptized, and say validly baptized, and they're both eligible to marry. And they marry before the Presbyterian minister. They both receive the sacrament of marriage.
Now, and what I meant in asking the question was really, I thought you said 2 weeks ago that a non-Catholic, the non-Catholic party does not receive the sacrament.
Well, if the non-Catholic party is not baptized.
Yes. Yes.
In other words, there are three possibilities. Either, well, no, there really would be four. Neither is baptized, that's one possibility. Both are baptized, second possibility. One of the two is baptized, and then you have either he or she. All right?
Yes.
Now, if both are baptized at the time of marriage, no matter what their religious profession is, and they marry validly, they ipso facto receive the sacrament of matrimony. If neither is baptized, they certainly receive no sacrament of matrimony. If only one of them is baptized, and they're validly married, neither receives the sacrament. And that's the hard one.
No, listen, see, if the Presbyterian couple you're talking about that received the sacrament of marriage, say if they divorce and they want to marry somebody who's Catholic, would the Catholic Church consider that first person is still being married?
Yes. Yes.
So they would treat it, they couldn't be them?
No. Sister.
Quite a few non-Catholics have said to me, one church is the same as the other. And if they took the words literally, you know, that they were Roman Catholics, then they would take it in the wrong context. But it's not used in that sense when you say they're really Roman Catholics. I mean, that would be confusing to them if they knew it, because they were trying to convince me that that all churches are the same.
Well, it isn't the same. But besides that, the Catholic Church does believe that she has the right to determine the conditions of marriage of her members. And her members are all the baptized.
Oh, I didn't mean about the marriage. I meant the fact that they considered the fact that they were baptized. I know that there's so many of them were fervent than many of the Catholics, well, some Catholic areas. And I know that they can go to heaven too. But their point was that the Congregationalists and a few others said that if you go to one church, it doesn't make any difference because all the churches are the same. And
well, of course, that's
even know the doctrine, so
that's not true otherwise.
But if like the term Roman Catholic to them, they would absolutely feel they had a ground to say, well, if we are Roman Catholic, doesn't that show?
No, because
that would just mean through the channel.
Matrimony is in a class by itself. It's the only sacrament where the two exchanging their consent confer the sacrament on one another, and the church, and only she has the right.
I'm sorry, Father, I didn't mean the matrimony. I meant the fact that they belong in the fullness of the church. Like when you were saying, I was bringing up what Brother said, that if you all people are baptized, then in some sense they are considered Roman Catholics too, and you use the expression they are Roman Catholics. I know they receive the channel of grace, but not in its fullness, but then we couldn't absolutely call them Catholics.
Well, I would say they are considered Roman Catholics in terms of their responsibility. They are not considered Roman Catholics in terms of their rights.
Oh.
A Protestant simply does not have the rights of a Catholic, but he does have the responsibilities, and the Church has a right to determine both. Then the grace of martyrdom. Now this is a new one, but it better be said, or the Lord knows what's awaiting even our own country by the end of the century, with over literally one half of the human race numerically be under communist domination today. And communism is spreading very fast. One country after another is becoming part of the communist empire, you might say. And even in countries like ours, where communism so far has not taken over. But the Holy Father in his encyclical speaks of the secularisms, not singular, but secularisms. We are living in a very secularist society in which if you want to be a good husband, a good wife, a good priest, a good religious, you've got to gird yourself for living a martyr's life. And I am not speaking poetically. And there are all kinds of clever dodges and ways of evading the responsibility. You have to be willing to either shed your blood physically, or at least what can be just as painful, like Our Lady, shedding your blood spiritually. In other words, we must be willing to undergo suffering and much opposition. As I've told people, for me it began in 1957. It's 23 years that I never dreamed what it means to be a priest in the modern world. It's in no books. I couldn't read any books to prepare myself. This is something we've got to learn by living it. And there's no protective custody for this. So the grace of martyrdom, we have the grace, all right, to suffer and if need be, die. Now membership in the church. Two things especially that the Vatican Council brought out regarding that effect of the baptismal character. It is the basis of the apostolate. In other words, as Christians, we are obliged, get the word, we are obliged to proclaim Christ. This is an obligation to teach Christ, to tell others about him, about the faith, about the church. And as by now we know, a lot of people, though they are nominal Catholics, are hardly zealous, to put it mildly, in sharing their faith with others. And the duty to share Christ's blessings. Now this is a little different than the apostolate, because just as we are obliged in virtue of our baptism to proclaim Christ, so we are to do everything in our power to lead people to share the blessings that we experience or enjoy, and thus bringing people to the use of the sacraments, urging people to pray. The blessings of membership in the church are to be obtained on certain conditions. Unless I pray, I don't get the graces. Unless I receive the sacraments, I don't get the graces. So it's not just a matter of proclaiming Christ in the apostolate. It is also striving to share what I possess with others. Third, incorporation into Christ for all Christians. This is the basic of the ecumenical movement, and it's a takeoff on what we've been saying all along. Everyone who is baptized just because they're validly baptized is a Christian and indeed a member of the Catholic Church. The ecumenical movement, as we now know it, is quite some years later. I've been writing about Protestantism for maybe 10 years. You might just, for the curiosity, look at a book that I published, I forget what year, somewhere in the 50s, called Christianity in Conflict. It sold pretty well, and then went out of print. And by that time, the ecumenical movement hit the church. Well, I just wouldn't publish a book like that now. Now, it was all above board, but I said many things about Protestants that I thought needed saying, which were more outspoken or frank than in today's climate I would want to write or an editor would want to publish. In other words, we've discovered a kinship among ourselves. All right? Now, the basis of that kinship is baptism. Why are we all brethren? Now, we call the other separated brethren. By the way, do you know the Protestants never call us separated brethren? You know that? Do you know why? Because they realize we're not separated from them, but we consider them separated from us. They don't have a principle of unity from which you can separate. And degrees. There are degrees of incorporation. While everyone who is validly baptized becomes, by that fact, a member of Christ's body, there are degrees and degrees of incorporation. Now, am I supposed to stop now? Well, people are shaking their heads. All right, we'll stop now. Yes. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. O Mary, conceived without sin,
pray for us who now recourse to thee.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. First, your assignments. Now, for the next time we meet, as you know, I'm going to be in Chicago next weekend, but the class will not be until 2 weeks. We will take up, under the sacraments, the sacrament of confirmation. Page
513.
So page 513 through 520. How's that? Okay? Not bad, eh?
No.
Although, you know, with a small number of pages, the questions become a little more subtle. Secondly, since we're starting on the religious vows as such, now, most of you, I think, did I give you an assignment to read from the present Holy Father's addresses on the religious life? No?
Yes. In general.
In general. Well, could I get a copy very quickly I'd like to assign a few sections of that book. By the way, if you don't have a copy, be sure to get it. It's a collection of all the... No, it's...
It's Visible Signs of the Gospel, published by the Daughters of St. Paul.
Now, since we're talking about the vows, suppose I ask you to read the following, call them chapters or talks of the Holy Father. Consecrated Love, page 16. Dimensions of Faithfulness, page 54. Dimensions of Faithfulness, page 54. Three passwords: pray, call, respond. Page 133. Three passwords: pray, call, respond. Page 1 starts at page 133. And Mary, the sign of hope for all generations. Mary, the sign of hope for all generations, the talk of the Holy Father in the United States on October the 7th. Page 206, it starts. Okay? Read those for the next assignment. Did we pray already? The moral law. Does that help you?
I can get the idea. As I said, strictly semantics.
Yes, I agree with
that. If it were not true, for example, the law of baptism, which is a universal law, unless a man be baptized of water and the Holy Spirit, he will not enter into the kingdom of heaven. There are 4.5 billion people in the world, of whom just about 1 billion plus are baptized Christians. The others could not be saved. We teach, however, that ignorance, the gospel not having been preached to them, they may be and are indeed excused from the obligation of being baptized. Number two, ignorance of the fact means ignorance of the law. 8 of you thought otherwise. Now, of course, it's a fact that some people are ignorant of the law. But technically, ignorance of a fact is not the same as ignorance of the law. Ignorance of the law means I don't know the law. Ignorance of the fact is whether a law which I know exists applies in this particular case. The one is not really the other. 3, my ignorance always makes me more responsible for what I do wrong in ignorance. 6 of you thought that was true. My ignorance always makes me more responsible. Well, no, that surely is not true. 4, the most culpable is affected ignorance. Well, I guess it's a question of knowing what affected ignorance means. Affected means insincere ignorance. It's not knowing deliberately. It's like forgetting on purpose. So it's the most culpable because I am both ignorant and I'm responsible deliberately for my ignorance. Number five, you all got that right. It's one of the lesser joys of a teacher. Concupiscence is natural to us since the fall of man, of Adam. Memorize that. Carve it in bronze. Concupiscence is natural to all of us. In other words, we all have unruly passions. And I wanted to make sure us. There are two notable exceptions that faith tells us. Who are they? Christ and Mary. Six, there is such a thing as concupiscence of the spirit along with concupiscence of the flesh. Eight of you doubted that. Please don't. Pride is concupiscence of the spirit. Envy. Number seven, actions induced by fear are less imputable or imputable than actions performed without fear. All right? 12, thought otherwise. Number 8, violence can be either physical or psychological. In other words, I can be coerced physically or I can be coerced and violence is practiced psychologically. What society practices widespread psychological violence? Communism. Number 9. I do not have to resist violence, urging me to perform some sinful action. Two of you thought that was true. Please don't. In other words, just because I am being somehow externally coerced doesn't mean, well, here goes. Does a woman have to? Is she obliged to resist a would-be rapist?
Yes.
Is she obliged?
Yes.
Morally?
Yes.
Yes. John?
I disagree.
You what?
I disagree.
Well, that's... Could you tell us why?
Because if she's threatened with death, to suffer being raped is
minor compared with death. Is that what you're saying? If you were a woman, you wouldn't say that.
Now, in other words, she can be raped. That doesn't mean she's committed a sin.
No,
if she internally, resists.
Well, yeah, but if she eternally resists and gives no external evidence, is that what you're saying?
See, the reason she externally says she's threatened with a knife, she has no choice.
What do you mean she has no choice?
She doesn't.
Because
Maria Gray? Yeah, I've heard of her.
Look, I was stopped on Park Avenue something over a year ago, 1 o'clock one morning, by a man who pulled out a knife. And I don't know what he was going to do, but I'm still here to say that he didn't do it. I used a certain amount of, you might say, psychological resistance, but I resisted. In other words, I talked to the man, I tried to dissuade him from, you're scared, aren't you? Well, I was, slightly. Moreover, to perform some sinful action, it needn't be rape, it may be something else. The essence of the sin, of course, is in the interior consent. But how sure I am, or how sure am I, that I really internally resist if I do go along with an externally very pleasant action. So that the resistance is not only to avoid the external action, the resistance is also that I might not internally consent. and a purely internal resistance to an external sinful action is, morally speaking, at least dubious.
Well, Father, what about all these rapes that occurred in the Congo of the nuns?
Yes.
They were wrong. They couldn't resist. They had no choice.
Well, now, we're not talking about successful resistance. Every reasonable effort must be made to avoid, in this case, being raped. Every reasonable effort must be made.
Isn't the psychological resistance of the act enough when you're in fear of your life?
No, because I risk consenting.
I think it would be impossible not to show externally, even if you were immobilized by fear, not to be crying or doing something. There would have to be the external.
In fact, this would almost be a dead giveaway that the person wants it.
Right, exactly.
Father, I was always going to also say, not only from a moral standpoint is it necessary to resist, but even from a legal standpoint, it is necessary to resist, because this is where the courts refuse to listen to women, because they say that they are accepting, that they are going along with being raped, and that it's not really rape.
We'll pick up, John, please.
Father, it'd be all right in this case then to, if we had the ability to somehow, you know, if we had a gun, for example, to shoot.
Oh yes. Yeah, resistance needn't be.
That would be all right then.
Passive. Needn't be just passive resistance, can be active. All kinds of methods available, but as a matter of fact, many attempted cases are not successful.
Father, I think some people think because the rape has taken place that there has been no resistance. I mean, there can be a lot of resistance and still take place. I mean, just because it happened doesn't mean the resistance wasn't there.
I think myself, any virtuous woman, without having read a book or taking this thing in class, would instinctively resist. Yes?
Father, I was held up in California, and the guy was about 250 pounds. You know, I only weigh 116. And he had a gun right in my umbilical cord, basically. And I started crying. And I don't know what he was going to do. And I said, oh, please don't do, you know, don't shoot me. And I cried so hard. And said I was going to scream. And, you know, he walked away. He got frightened. So I think verbally, if you...
All kinds of resistance, yes.
You
do something.
You're not going to, I mean, a guy that big, well, you kick him and you're dead. But you can cry. And women know are, you know, good actresses.
Oh, this is a very...
I want to tell you about rape. At Cook County Hospital, when I was there a student, they said 98% of the women never get penetrated. They call it aberrational sex, that these women really are. It's just an attack on women, and they really do not... The whole act is not complete. It's proven fact. The women are so afraid that...
And partly, I suppose, because of their own physical condition at the time.
Yeah, but it's not true. They never
Doctor?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, there's been a lot of brainwashing in America about women should submit,
right.
You know, completely.
Yeah.
And the one of the big cases here was the Speck case.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of the Speck, they were mostly nurses, and all of the American nurses submitted to Specht and were killed. And the only one of the group who was not, I think there was two, maybe
one.
Philippine girl hadn't been culturized enough, and she really hid out and was under a bed. And she's the only one who came out alive. And recently, as bad as his show is, on the Phil Donahue show, they had some rapists who had been convicted. And to a man, they said that in their specific cases, if the woman had really resisted, they probably would have run away. So this is a brainwashing going on that we shouldn't.
This is, this number 9 is not a trivial question.
That's right.
Sister.
You could be even, supposing you were forced to sign a paper saying you rejected God and that you were no longer a Catholic, they could use a lot of violence for you to do that, and you could use the same tactic then.
Well, nowadays, with the faith problems we've got, how many Catholics are giving in passively to implicit apostasy just in order not to be rejected? They're so fearful. In other words, we have become a very passive society. So it touches not merely, say, sex, but every other aspect of human existence where people are afraid to, well, to even say anything.
Well, Father, then, is psychological resistance in the matter of rape sufficient without any physical resistance? Is it moral?
Well, no, if by psychological resistance, there must be some external manifestation. Otherwise, it doesn't qualify as resistance. In our sense, there must be some manifestation that I'm resisting. Verbal, of course, all kinds of ways. Thanks for the contributions. Number 10. All human actions are either morally good or morally bad. 4 of you doubted that. Please don't. I wish to repeat. My effort is honestly, with all the sincerity in me, to make these questions as obvious as possible. I'm not trying to trick anybody. So all human actions, that's the definition of the term. All human actions are moral actions. And moral actions are either good or bad. Which I think also says something about our culture. We talk about somebody acting morally as though it means acting well, right? A moral action is an action performed with one's free will, whether it's good or bad. Number 11, underline the term that best completes each sentence. The motive for an action is the purpose. 12, fear is mental trepidation caused by some present or future danger. Again, I just thought I was very clear. There were no tricks to it. Present or future danger. 13, the object of a moral action is what is done. The motive we said above is the purpose. 14, only one said otherwise. A moral act is good when the object, circumstances, and motives are good. When any one of the three is bad, then the whole action is bad. Number 15, a moral act is bad when what is done, or the motive, or the circumstances under which it is done are or is bad. And 2 of you evidently doubted that. 16. Invincible ignorance is inculpable. That's what it means. That's another word for invincible. Number 17. Concupiscence is a result of sin and tendency to sin. 10 of you thought otherwise. Well, may I ask, I really need to know this. Did any of you answer concupiscence is a tendency to sin? Would you let me know?
Yeah, I did.
Why did you say that? And why did you not say result of sin and tendency to sin?
Well, I don't know. We all know it's a result of Adam's sin. But
oh, I see. You just figured it, take it for granted, eh?
See, everybody knows that.
Well, as you can see, in this case, the teacher knows nothing. He wants to be informed. All right. Number 18. We now have concupiscence because we have lost the original gift of integrity. Not innocence, because that's what sin means. Nor immortality, because that's not why we have concupiscence. We are now going to die because we have lost the original gift of immortality. But concupiscence is the result of the loss of the gift of integrity. Number 19. Because of concupiscence, our desires seek fulfillment. Before and after, conscience tells us something is morally good or bad. Would somebody tell me why they gave another answer? I'd like to know.
They gave another answer, but I don't know why.
Somebody else have, who said something else and can give us a reason? Well, that's pretty important, because concupiscence means that we have these urges or desires which ignore conscience before we make a decision, and after we make the decision that something is, say, bad, does concupiscence suddenly turn off? So it continues, all right? So we have to know that concupiscence continues before, during, and after we have made up our minds that something is either good or bad. And finally, the largest number that missed any question is number 20. 16. Our culpability is always increased. No. He is unaffected. Well, not quite. He is always lessened by concupiscence, which precedes a human action. Could I get some feedback from somebody in class?
Father, what's the correct answer for that one?
Our culpability is always lessened by concupiscence, which precedes a human action.
I had it marked wrong, and it was...
Please?
My copy was marked wrong, and I have the correct answer. So maybe that's why you got so many, 16.
Oh, that may be. Anybody else? The correct answer is always lessened. Well, by the way, Sister Catherine, be sure that, because this is for the this is for the ages. We're making a keeping a record. Do you follow the logic of that? In other words, who was more guilty, or who is more guilty? A person that has strong passions urging him to do something, and he does it, or one whose concupiscence is not so strong and he does it with full deliberation? Clearly, the one who does it with full deliberation and has minimal urges. Now notice, we don't say that concupiscence removes culpability. All right? By the way, who says that? There was a large group of Christians, numbered in the millions, who, by whether they realize it or not, their vocabulary may be different from ours, but who believe on principle that because of concupiscence, no one is responsible for any moral action. My day would be made, as I keep telling you, if you get the right answer. Who says that?
Lutherans.
The what?
Lutherans.
Protestants.
Yeah.
That is Protestantism. Isn't that good to hear? I mean, it's sad, but it's good to know. Because in Protestant theology, original sin equals concupiscence. And therefore, because, and insofar as a person has original sin, and the Protestant vocabulary, everybody has it. No one is responsible. No one is responsible for any evil action that he performs.
But the Protestants baptize, don't they?
That's right.
They don't believe that baptism removes everything from sin.
No, they don't. Justification in the Protestant vocabulary is not the removal of original sin. Anytime a Protestant holds that, and there are some, I suppose, who do, they have been unwittingly Catholicized.
I was once arguing with a Protestant, and he said that everything man does is sort of sinful, that man is inherently sinful. Now, isn't that just the opposite of what you just said?
No, because it depends on who the source of the sin is. The same gentleman, or was it a lady, who said this, might have further been informed, maybe he already told you, that it's due to the sin of Adam, which has deprived mankind of the use of their free will. I've taught so many Protestants, so many courses in Protestantism, that I tell my students, whatever else you forget, see a semester course in some graduate theology of Protestantism, please don't forget this. The heart of Protestantism on the moral side is the denial of human freedom. And this is what is our main problem in the Western world. That's the bedrock. That's why we don't have enough room to fill to take care of our criminals. People are just not responsible. Right now, I am told by people in the legal profession that criminals have more rights by the law than their victims. So that's number 20. By the way, the 16 who missed it, pardon me, the 15 who missed it, be sure, however, for our purpose, that concupiscence does lessen culpability. It emphatically does not remove it. And also, let me add, part of our grave responsibility as Christians is to gradually overcome this concupiscence. How? What is the only thing that can cope with fallen human nature? And what is the surest way, the infallible way, the indispensable way of getting grace?
Prayer.
So a person couldn't say, well, woe is me. My concupiscence is active again. And consequently, well, I am not fully responsible. Because if I've neglected prayer, I am therefore responsible for my lack of control, which God's grace would have given me had I had the wisdom and humility to pray. Thank you. Now we pick up where we left off. What number did we finish with?
35.
All right. As we've been doing, I would like to have you quickly just look at the answer. You have questions and answers, correct? And then I'd like to make comments on each one of these, and then for a moment to ask for some feedback from the class, so we will not unnecessarily repeat what you already have written down. The question has to do with conscience. Notice, conscience is a judgment. Therefore, conscience belongs to the mind. It is a quality of the intellect. It is not something in the will, less still in the emotions. Our conscience is a thinking power. The word conscience refers to the intellect in one very specific kind of thinking activity, namely, when it is making judgments about whether a given action, a moral act, is good or bad. Another word for conscience, therefore, is the intellect, thinking morally. That's a good homemade definition of conscience. The intellect thinking morally. I don't want to lose anybody because it's less important for us to cover the 450-some questions we have in the course. And given our present pace, I'm not sure we're going to cover all 450. But it's much less important to cover the 450 questions than for you to understand what we're saying. Do you agree?
Yes.
So, any questions before we go on? What are the possible qualities of the conscience? There are four, as you have your... Do all of you have question 37?
Yes.
Okay. Certain and its opposite, which is doubtful. Correct and its opposite, which is false. You may substitute the word true for the word correct. And then you may substitute false with the word erroneous. And that might even be better. Certain, doubtful, true, or false, or correct, or erroneous. In other words, the opposite of correct is, strictly speaking, erroneous. The opposite of false is, strictly speaking, true. But the words are used interchangeably. With that as vocabulary, sister, there's somebody here without. What is a certain conscience? The English word certain is not the best, because certain can mean a specific conscience. Well, that's meaningless here. The word certain means a sure conscience. And therefore we define it as that state of mind on a moral issue in which a person is sincerely sure about the morality, meaning the goodness or the badness of a given action. What do we mean by sincerely sure? In other words, the person is honestly sure. He is honestly sure. Because clearly a person could be sure about something, but not be sincere in his certitude. Again, the word morality has to do with whether the action is either morally good or morally bad. And the given action that we're talking about is either future or past. Now this, I think, bears emphasis, because my conscience should be sure or certain not only before I do something, but after I've done something. In other words, I've performed an action. It's a past act. I reflect on what I've done. my conscience, looking back at what I've done, may be sure in the sense of certain that what I've done, say, is good, or that what I've done is morally bad. All right? What we commonly and more properly, or popularly, think of the morality of a given future action, but not only. To cover the whole bill, a certain conscience refers to both future and past mobile act. Any questions? When is the conscience doubtful? Well, it refers to the person's mind. But I want to clarify, none of these answers, by the way, is all that clear by itself, because you don't answer as pointed a question of when is the conscience doubtful by just a simple declarative sentence. When is it doubtful? When a person is undecided about the moral goodness of a course of action. But notice, the indecision is precisely about whether the act is good or bad. The indecision is not whether I should do the action. Am I clear? Mm-hmm. Now, I may be undecided whether I should do it because I'm not sure whether it's good or bad. But the focus, the target of the doubt, is undecided whether it's good or bad. Are we clear? Mm-hmm. That kind of indecision may also produce an indecision whether I should do it. But that's not a doubtful conscience. Let me ask a question. Suppose I am not in doubt about a given action. I know that it's bad. And I consciously and with full awareness am undecided whether I should do it. What's the state of soul as a result of that? I've done wrong. Are we clear? I may not be undecided.
Depending on the circumstances.
Well, of course, but I mean, if I know that something is wrong, I can say, well, I should I or shouldn't I? In other words, I must internally first and externally, if necessary, say no. Thank you. Where did we start? Please?
Quarter of.
Okay. Well, let's continue for a few minutes so I can get this call in. Number 40. When is the conscience correct, or when is it true? Now, the word truth, in any case, and especially in this case, means the correspondence of mind with reality. The mind is outside of reality, or reality is outside of it. In the real world, outside of my mind, whether I think about it or not, whether I know it or not, is abortion murder?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it gravely sinful?
Yes.
Yes. So the facts of the case are that abortion, in reality, abortion, A equals M. Okay? My mind, reflecting on, say, a possible abortion. See, I am the person implicated, whether as a doctor or the woman who is being urged to have an abortion. Now, suppose my mind tells me inside of me that abortion is not murder. Is my conscience true or false?
False.
Okay. Why? Because there is not correspondence or conformity between what is outside of the mind with what is inside of the mind. And consequently, there is truth when the mind says inside A equals M. In other words, when what is outside of the mind corresponds with what is inside of the mind. And consequently, a correct conscience, or really better, a true conscience. But the word is not much used, true conscience, because with our mixed up vocabulary, all kinds of meanings could be attached to true conscience. A person is sincere. Can a person be sincerely wrong?
Right. Yes. Correct.
Dead wrong.
Yes.
And yet the person might say, well, but I'm sincere. Well, Buster, that has nothing to do with it. You're wrong. John.
I don't think it's possible.
You don't think it's possible?
For the mind ever to say that abortion is not murder. But it's the reality.
Justin, say that again.
I don't think
you
it's...
You don't think... Take it easy. You don't think it is possible for the mind ever to say that abortion is not murder.
Right.
Why do you say that?
Because of conscience.
Well,
the idea of conscience. In other words, I say it's the reality that we find ourselves in, that it's the media that's saying
abortion is
all right.
Well, but all right, here is a brainwashed mind. See, I'm not defending that judgment. I'm just stating a fact. Is it possible for a person to be so brainwashed, so bewitched, so drugged by the media, as I think you're saying, to claim that abortion is not murder?
True.
Is it possible for a brainwashed mind to say that abortion is not murder?
True. Yes.
Right. Okay. And that kind of a conscience then, in making that judgment, is said to be false. Okay?
If you were to change that to suicide is murder.
It's, first of all, is de facto, objectively, in the real order, is this a true statement? S equals M. Suicide is murder.
Now, if a convict...
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, if a convict knows he is going to the chair...
Yes.
Does he have a choice to take his own life when he knows there's
no
appeal? No,
he does not have a choice. He may not take his own life. No. The state, under really divine authority, may convict justly condemned criminals for major crimes, like, say, murder. But no one, even though he's absolutely sure that he's going to be, say, electrocuted, may anticipate the electrocution and say, I'll take my own life. That's why what Socrates, remember, among the ancient Greeks, remember Socrates, who drank hemlock? Well, he may be pictured as a hero, but by Christian standards, he committed suicide. Doctor.
And you would also agree that a prisoner of war who had a vital secret in defense of his country, and with fear that he might reveal the secret, could not commit suicide.
He could not commit suicide. He could not commit suicide. Even though the end in view is a good one, you may not use an evil means. Suicide, I mean, knowingly and willingly, we're assuming all that goes into suicide. We may not perform an evil action, no matter how good foreseeable effect, as in this case, would be. Brother, if you don't mind, otherwise I won't get my call in. And besides, we have been at it for 65 minutes. Let's make a sign of the cross to show that we're taking a break. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. I believe we go until 2:45, is that right? We're on the subject of conscience, and specifically question 40, which we covered. Question 41 almost takes care of itself. It is, of course, the opposite of a correct or true conscience. The essence of the error, notice, is discord or disagreement between what is really true and what's on my mind. Thus, if God says that something is morally good and I think it's morally bad, I have a false conscience. If God says something is morally bad and I think it's good, I have a false conscience. 42. Is it permissible to act with a doubtful conscience? I cannot emphasize too much the importance of that answer. We are never allowed to act with a doubtful conscience. The implication, of course, is that if I don't know whether something is good or bad, am I free to go ahead and do it? Am I morally free to do what I'm not sure is either morally good or bad? No. Because by prior implication, if it's morally bad, and it may be because the presumption is I don't know, I may not do something which could be morally bad, because in effect I'm saying I don't care. Bill?
Are there ever circumstances whereby there are just two possible routes of action and you really don't know if either is morally good, but you have to take one of them because of the circumstances? Or you're bound to act, you cannot just sit? I mean, physically it's impossible.
No. In other words, as the next question answers, what should a person with a doubtful conscience do? Either somehow resolve the doubt or not perform the action. Now, the manner of resolving a doubtful conscience, that's another question. But no, I may not act with a doubtful conscience. Doubtful, notice, whether what I am being either urged to do or what is before me, that it might be morally bad, yes?
Well, in regard to, like, the election, you know, one man says that he's against abortion, one says he's for. One is a divorced man, one is, in other words, your choices are both, according to what you believe in, wrong, or both. What do you do in a case like that? They say we have to take the lesser of the evil.
So that then would not be a doubtful conscience.
But you're still
doing something that's...
Well, first of all, voting in the United States elections is not morally bad, all right? We agree.
Yeah.
Apart from who is the candidate, voting is a legitimate action. Indeed, not only is it legitimate, but is it laudable? Is it praiseworthy?
Yes.
Can it even be a duty?
Yes.
Okay. So the question is not whether I should vote or not, but whether I should vote for this or that person. So what I have to do is resolve, really, a doubt or an uncertainty about either the law, which there shouldn't be any doubt, or the fact. Now, you're wondering whether, where exactly would be your doubt? That might help.
Option of voting.
Well, that's not my doubt. My doubt is that Carter is supporting ERA and abortion, and Mr. Reagan is a divorced man who, you know, they'll be the first president in our country who has, you know, in that high office, who has had two wives.
Well, I would say then it's a question of weighing the pros and cons. In other words, neither is an ideal candidate.
Yeah.
That's agreed. As a matter of fact, in all the years that I have voted, I have yet to vote for an ideal candidate. The one that I might have voted for in 1928, I was too young to vote for Al Smith. So you have to resolve on whatever grounds or premises that between Carter and Reagan, well, I don't want to put it this bluntly, but which one would do less damage to the country? Doctor.
You know, and Bill's thing, we still have to recognize that by not doing something, we can be morally wrong. And we can come up to a particular time element where we must either do something or not do something at this time, and then the time is passed. At that moment, we may have tried to get authority, but we have to either take an action or not take an action. And we may not be morally certain at that time.
Well, we may be, however, and this is why the next question comes up, 45 or 44. How can a person with a doubtful conscience resolve his doubt? Now, there are all kinds of ways of resolving the doubt. You know, find out what the church teaches, or read a book, or whatever. But that may not be possible. So let's read the answer. He should ask for light in prayer. That's one way. I'm in doubt because I don't have enough grace, so I pray. Or look for information from approved sources. Who will tell me? I don't see what you're doubtful about. Here's the answer. Thanks. Then you act. Or consult informed persons. All right? Or finally, follow the doctrine of probabilism. So there are four ways of resolving a doubtful conscience. Now the fourth one is the delicate one. By the way, do the other three make sense? You resolve the doubt by finding out from somebody who knows. And then that person certainly becomes yours. If you believe the person, that's the end of that. So 45, since probabilism is one way in which this can be settled, how can probabilism be used? I don't know how much of what I've got here you have in your... You just have that answer, right?
Yes.
That's all. And then I've got 3, 4, 5, 6 pages of commentary.
That's why they only got the question and answer.
And they did not get that commentary?
No.
Okay. Well, I didn't expect you to. First, before we get into the subject of probabilism, as you probably know, pardon the expression, as you may know, probabilism as a theory in moral theology was created by the Jesuits. It should not be a priori suspect for that reason. It is an opinion which is approved by the church. There are various forms of probabilism. In general, and maybe the best thing I can do is to go to the dictionary, otherwise I'm liable to spend so much time on this that we won't go on to question 46. Probabilism, the moral theory that holds that a law against whose existence or application there stands a solidly probable argument does not bind. So is a theory which holds that a law against whose existence or application there stands a solidly probable opinion or argument that law does not bind. It is based on the principle that a doubtful law does not bind the conscience. It therefore excludes other theories as either too strict or too lax about the degree of doubt or probability that it would exempt one from the obligation of a doubtful law. Now that's the, you might say, dictionary definition of probabilism. By way of commentary, probabilism is a set of practical rules to help settle a doubtful conscience. What is a solidly probable opinion? This is an opinion based on reason, or reasons that are serious enough to win the assent of a prudent person without excluding the possibility of error. Consequently, in order to resolve a doubt by probability, I should have some grounds based on reason justifying a given course of action. Provided I have such reasonable grounds, I may act according to that position or opinion, even though somebody else has another opinion. You might say that provided when I'm in doubt, I can become probably certain that a given course of action is legitimate, I may go ahead and perform it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Now, how I arrive at that probable certainty will depend on the circumstances in which I find myself. Normally, this is consulting somebody whose judgment I trust. I don't have to know the reasons for that person's judgment. Am I still making sense?
Isn't that an invasion of situation ethics, though, Father?
Well, no, because as doctor said, I must act. See, if I can abstain from acting, well, I should, until I resolve the doubt in some other way. This is an ad hoc decision that must be made. Like, for example, the phone call that I just had. No choice. Had to express a judgment right there. And had to make a moral decision. So that provided the judgment on which I act is that of a prudent person. In other words, I'm not copping out. I want to know what I should do. I therefore consult, assuming that my own conscience is in doubt, whether the one I consult has written something and I read it, or I call them up and they tell me. And even without, as I say, because it may be such an urgent action, I don't have time to even go into studying the pros and cons. Somebody had her hand up.
It's not exactly suicide, but say, for instance, a person is on life-saving equipment. And we talk about it a lot nowadays because they prolong people's lives. Do you have the right to say, pull the plugs?
Do I have?
Or
you're speaking
you
to me.
If you don't know what to do yourself, you ask your doctor. And in that case, your mind isn't settled on the thing. You ask your doctor, and he says yes.
Well, then the condition for following the doctor's judgment would be, is he a prudent and, morally upright person? Yes. In fact, I think most of those decisions are made that way, don't you think? Someone whose judgment you trust, you consult, and then, without a further thought, you act on that judgment. Doctor?
Would you say a word to exclude from this probabilism the woman who would go from confessor to confessor to find one who says it's okay to use the pill?
Of course. Well, if there is a doubtful conscience, it's a self-induced doubt. In other words, what is presumed all along, it is a sincerely doubtful conscience. There is no effort, even implicit, to evade the obligations of the law. Lucille.
Is this probabilism could that be construed as a practical judgment? I mean, in a situation, for instance, an elderly person who is confronted with, shall she go to Mass on a Sunday that's very icy? She's in good health herself, but she may not be if she goes out under these conditions, so she makes a practical judgment of staying home.
No. No, because then if she makes a practical judgment, then she's no longer in doubt. See, we're assuming the person is in sincere doubt, and there's no way of resolving that doubt from within my own mind. Then if a practical judgment is made, then a formerly doubtful conscience becomes certain by the person's... Well, every moral judgment is a practical judgment. We don't have mathematical certitude in moral matters. Now, this is really assuming the person is in doubt, him or herself. Under what condition? Now, there are other ways of resolving the doubt, but one way in which the doubt may be resolved is by following probabilism, which means following an opinion evidently expressed by somebody else, because I'm the one who is in doubt. An opinion which says you may do it, even though someone else might give me an opposite opinion. But I am free to follow a solidly probable opinion. This is the general position. Bill?
Suppose we take a situation which actually came up recently, one of our pro-life groups. When definitions, so-called, change, talking about ordinary and extraordinary actions to save a life, who can properly resolve that? The doctor who says an operation is ordinary or extraordinary, or a moral theologian who says, in his knowledge, it is ordinary or extraordinary? And I'm talking about now in the case of what I would call infanticide, where a child has Down's disease, mongoloidism, and an operation to save that child's life by removing a bowel obstruction, which I maintain is an ordinary operation nowadays, is not done because the person said it's an extraordinary action, which maybe in the middle of the 18th century it was, and therefore you may be permitted not to feed because you can't feed the child because they just won't attend, and therefore you let them start.
Well, I'd say the same thing that I said earlier. In other words, it depends on how urgent the action is. If it is urgent, and I'm an adult, say myself, well, then I consult, and then I'm at the mercy of the people that somehow surround me. And then, before God, I do the best I can, and if I can't find out by myself, if I can, I should, of course. But if I don't know, I consult, and the conditions that we've identified, a person who is prudent and a morally responsible individual whose judgment I would trust in moral matters. Now, if I can't find out from such a person, well then by that time the child might die, right? So it's a question of taking action and taking it as expeditiously as possible, and that's why there are people available to give me that judgment. Now if objectively, I may be mistaken. The person who gives me the opinion may be wrong. But I've done what I could, and I resolved the doubt to the extent to which I could. And I act on the basis of the information available to me. John.
Father, I take a different viewpoint. I think as to faith in Christ, that we obtain reasonable answers to the moral problems we have today. Now, see, I've been presented the same, the same understanding that you're trying to give us, but I disagree.
You just couldn't buy it, eh? Mm-hmm. Well, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying that if a person is, I guess, sufficiently spiritual, united with God, that he won't have these doubts. Is that what you're saying? That God's grace will supply the light. Well, I must say the facts of the church's history don't warrant that. In other words, great saints. Take a Teresa of Avila. There are very few people who are more enlightened than she. All I can tell you, having read her life, and knowing a certain amount about Teresa, see, she had many doubtful situations in which she had to consult. And then humbly she followed the advice of those whom she trusted and whose judgment she followed. John.
You see, Father, that is just another instrument of doing what Christ wanted her to do.
Well then, well thanks, John. Well then, what you're saying. Well, thanks for joining our camp. Yeah, all right. You're correct. That's good. In other words, we don't really disagree as much as you may have thought, you see?
No. I know we agree.
Sure, that's it. Yeah, we do agree, John.
But I do disagree.
Well, think about it. Okay?
Yeah, I was thinking, at the beginning of the course you said there were two types of ignorance, ignorance of law and ignorance of fact. And I read somewhere that there are two ways to resolve a doubtful conscience, either, and they gave two precepts, the doubtful law is not binding, and follow the morally safer course. And it seems to me...
The morally safer course.
Right.
Well, that's, of course, precisely where probabilism does not follow that. That's a theory, too.
I see. Well, it seemed to me that, like, when you know...
That is called, by the way, just to have... Maybe you've seen it in print. And I think it's in the dictionary. Look, I never know what's in here. Oh, yes. It's called probabiliarism. Probabiliarism, a theory in moral theology for resolving practical doubts. Okay? Probabiliarism maintains that one may follow the opinion favoring liberty when the reasons for this opinion are certainly more probable than those which favor the law. You've got to have stronger reasons than just merely probable grounds. In other words, this is the safer course. Now, see if I've got the other. Yes. It's also called tushierism. The Latin word for safe is tutus. means safe. That's the basic degree. If it's safer, it's called tutior. Tutior. Then you just add ism. Now in moral theology, this is synonymous with rigidism. Which is not approved by the church. That you must follow the safer course. Does that help a little bit? In other words, when you have a doubt on some question involving the moral order, do you have to follow the safer opinion? John?
See, the way I look at it, reason is based on faith.
Reason is based on faith. Well, I must say, John, that's a new one. You said faith is based on reason. Well, it just happens, John, that faith is based on reason. It just happens. Yeah.
I disagree.
Well, I mean, you're privileged to disagree. I mean, it's your privilege. But, yes, faith is based on reason. I must have reasonable grounds, rational grounds for my faith.
Okay. See, because that doesn't apply to inspiration. Okay. In other words, Abraham.
All right.
When he was going to sacrifice his son.
Yes.
That didn't seem reasonable, but the reason he was doing it because of his faith in God.
Yeah, but Abraham wouldn't have believed in God. In other words, was he unreasonable in believing in God? Was he unreasonable? It has nothing to do with it.
It doesn't. Faith is faith.
Well,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, for example, take the 500 million Muslims. They've got a strong faith, many of them, as we're discovering in Iran. I would not call their faith reasonable. Right? In fact, we have a word for it. My definition of unreasonable faith is fanaticism. That doesn't mean that I figure out with reason what I believe, but there must be some grounds for believing. That's why Christ worked miracles. That's why he did so many wonderful things, so that the mind wouldn't just believe in spite of itself, but that it would be reasonable. That doesn't mean that I understand the mysteries of faith, but I better have rational grounds for having the faith. Now, John, you must come to New York, and I happen to be teaching a whole semester just on faith, and it would be delightful to have you in class. Yes? A simple example of Tusharism. Well, let's take your example of voting, say now in the forthcoming elections. Is it 10 days to the
November?
No, whatever it is. Now, a person is in doubt. Now, where would your doubt be, or not necessarily yours, but where would you place the doubt to vote for?
That they both had an imperfection morally.
Yes. And what then would be the doubt? Wherein is the conscience doubtful? About what?
Voting.
About whether you should vote.
For them.
Okay. So, okay. Here, the doubt is whether I should vote. Is that it? I'm in doubt?
For either one of them.
For either one. Okay. Now, Tusharism, or rigidism, would say that I may not vote unless my all contrary, in other words, I can think of 10 reasons why I should vote, right? For one of them, for example, the lesser of two evils. Which one will do less damage to the country? Okay? Which I think is a solidly probable opinion. It's just as well that Reagan and Carter are not listening. But suppose a person came along and said, no, you may not vote. It would be even sinful to vote. Unless you assured yourself that either Reagan or Carter would positively benefit the country. In other words, you must have very solidly grounded reasons which are over and above all the probable reasons why a person should vote, as we've earlier explained. In other words, that the safer course, if you want to vote, is to make certain that either Carter or Reagan will be of positive benefit to the country. And I would say that kind of judgment I don't think we can make. You'd have to read the future.
Using the simple question of doubt that she had, the reason was this, if I may just reply to it, Reagan's divorce. Number one, he was not Catholic, so it was not a divorce in the Catholic Church, number one. And it affected his particular life and a life. Abortion affects the life of millions. So you're weighing a single sin, if you want to reflect on a single sin of divorce, versus a sin against millions and a direct sin against God. That would be my contribution to her dilemma.
Well, I don't really have a dilemma. I was using it, but I think Father answered it when he said that the church did not approve. I think sometimes
the church does not approve rigidism.
Yeah.
Tusharism is not approved by the church's moral teaching.
In other words, Father, what I was finding out is in some cases, such as abortion, there is a moral question that's black and white. Right?
Yes.
Never is abortion ever a probable cause.
No doubt.
Whereas in the other case, there are doubts from time to time. And that was the...
Yes, and this is where, in other words, what it means in practice, this is, now, let's go back to probabilism. What it means in practice, it's really much more simple than all this verbiage may seem to indicate. Right. What it means in practice, my own conscience is in doubt. And there is no built-in reason in my own mind to resolve the doubt. I have to act. So I get somebody's judgment, which makes sense. Now what reasons, like the ones you gave, you see, you might tell someone to vote for Reagan, you have your reasons. You don't have to give those reasons. And the person then would be permitted by the mobile law we're talking about to follow your judgment, trusting, say, in your integrity. You have your reasons. You don't have to voice those reasons. Tell the person, go ahead and vote for Reagan. Okay? And it's following someone's judgment who presumably either has access to knowledge you don't have, or is more intelligent than you are, or whatever. Or maybe, for example, under emotional strain, the conscience can become confused. So you consult somebody who is not confused, who is not personally involved in the decision-making. It's that simple, but also that important. Yes?
Well, what if you don't have time to consult someone?
Well, then you don't act. In other words, the urgency of the action, you cannot act on a doubtful conscience. In other words, if you push me to the wall and all these methods are either not available or they've been tried and found wanting, then I don't act on the doubtful conscience.
What if not acting, like the situation that was brought up earlier, you know, where not acting is making a choice, you know. You know what I mean? That it's going to have bad consequences, not acting, too.
Well, I would still say, in other words, it's not the consequences that make the morality of the action, it's whether what I am doing in itself is morally wrong. In other words, if the circumstances are such that I am called upon to act and I have to act, I might almost call it, you know, an obligation, then the one who's putting the pressure on me or the circumstances, in other words, I would then be not culpable. But as long as I have the choice of making a decision, I cannot make a decision that I'm not responsible. Yes.
So when you really get to the split second thing, I think that the first one's probably the best anyway. Ask for light in prayer and then just do what you do and trust God to...
You pray and you ask for light and you trust that the Lord is giving you light.
Yes. And if you act wrongly, He can bring good out of bad. If it gets right down to that.
John, we'll come to you after. By the way, let's take one or two more because we don't want to spend all the time on what really is not. That was very interesting, but really it isn't all that basic. Do you have a question?
Yeah, presently in Milwaukee, there's a situation. An officer was confronted on the street by a man accosting him with a knife.
Pardon me, there are seats. There are plenty of seats available. Okay, Jerome.
A case in Milwaukee. A police officer was approached by a man with a knife, not walking to him, but running for him. Yet the police officer admitted in question that he looked like he might have been under the influence of drugs or something, but at the moment, the decision was he warned the man, pulled his gun, he kept approaching with the open knife, and he shot him. The man died on the way to the hospital. And an immediate decision, his life or the man's. And yet he did admit in questioning that the man appeared to be under the influence of some drug or liquor or something. And yet he made the decision to fire. One shot, the man died and went to the hospital. What was, my question is twofold. How would that relate to the police officer's decision versus how would that relate to an ordinary citizen on the street would have had the same ability, for example, to unarm him with his knife or invert the knife so that the attacker became the wounded victim. Is there any difference in that type of discipline and decision?
Well, I would say in general the officer was justified because we may use whatever means are necessary to save our life from what is called an unjust aggressor. Now, it would be a little strange for an ordinary citizen to have a gun. But whether he had a gun or had access to some lethal weapon, and that at the moment you don't figure these things out, you don't have the time.
Well, say the citizen, though, because of the man's intoxication, wasn't quite as coordinated, was able to somehow, whatever move he made, take the knife while even in the man's hand and turn it on the individual who attacked him. Would that be justified?
Well, it would be. Yes, it would be. It would be justified. In other words, we may use physical force, even to death, to protect ourselves, our lives, from an unjust aggressor.
But is the priest in Milwaukee saying that the officer did wrong?
Well, there are other priests I know who are also mistaken. This one was mistaken. Shall we go on? John, pardon me, if you don't mind, we have to go on. We go till 3 o'clock, is it? Please? Okay. Number 46. What is law? Law is a directive of reason issued for the common good by one in charge of a community. Several comments on that statement. Sometimes the word, instead of directive, I use the word directive, but the standard books in moral theology generally use ordinance. But the word is not so clear, at least in my vocabulary. So directive means it is an ordinance, which carries the idea of ordering. Notice, it is not a mere, you might say, suggestion or encouragement. A law is an order. Of reason. There are few words, in fact, I would say there's no single word in Catholic moral theology that is more important than the word reason in the definition of law. And the reason is because so much of the world doesn't admit that. The essence of law is in the mind. Now, of course, the reason, being in the mind, is somehow implemented by the will of the legislator. All right? But the essence of law is something which is in the legislature's mind and not in his arbitrary will. You begin to see the implications of that? In other words, as Catholicism understands law, first of all, let's handle the obvious parts of the definition. Evidently, to have law, you must have a society. Law applies to society or community. Secondly, to have a law, you must have someone who is in charge of that society, someone in authority. Thirdly, to have a law, what the one in authority directs or orders the members of that society to do, he must somehow make known to them, otherwise known as promulgation. Again, that which the one who orders, who is in authority, must be for the common good, for the welfare of the members of that society. So all of those features are assumed as part of any authentic law. But what is not obvious is that to be a law, it must be a directive or an ordinance, not of the will, but of reason. Meaning what? Meaning that as the Catholic Church understands law, going back to her earliest years. She assumes that the reason, that is, the faculty of judgment of the lawgiver, reflecting on the needs of the members of that community, then decides that something is, well, to be done, or something is forbidden for the welfare of that society. Forbid something which would threaten the society, or command something which would be good for the society. But notice, the basis of the law is in the mind of the legislator. The reason makes a judgment, and only then, on the basis of that reason judgment, does the legislator order or direct. Because if we omitted the word reason, as so many definers of law, when they even bother defining law, mean, if it were the will, or worse still, the emotions, we would have either chaos in the case of emotions, or sheer tyranny in the case of the will. Any questions? Okay. John, you must have another question.
Father, who is the lawgiver?
God, the ultimate lawgiver.
Okay. And see, he set up men in authority, right?
That's right. But he does not allow people in authority to use their wills arbitrarily. They must use their reason.
He's the lawgiver, and he reveals through the Holy Spirit to the people, right?
To the people? Well, who's making the law? The people or the lawgiver?
In government situations, the people.
Well, they elect somebody who is. There, somebody must be in charge. The people can't be in charge of themselves.
Yeah,
somebody must be in authority.
People are in charge of the government. People are elected to office.
But they're not the authority.
Yes, they are.
Not if it's a, pardon me, not if it's a rational society. Which, by the way, is a problem we're running into in our country. Where everybody is a law to him or herself, and we're the people. What I don't like, I don't do.
But you're missing the point.
So what's the point?
Well, maybe that's what it is, conversion.